This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug-bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
Okay, coming at you, not shirtless, but extremely bundled up. Is it fair to say that, are we in South Central? Are we like too far north to be out of South Central Alaska?
I feel like we're closer to interior.
Yeah, I'd say this is interior.
I can say we're in interior Alaska, and I'm not being like melodramatic.
That counts.
On a lake, perched over a spear hole, there's about 3 feet of ice on the lake. We have a hole chopped through the ice. It's about 3.5 feet by 2.5 feet, would you say?
Yeah, that's about right.
Looking at a bottom. We're on about 8 feet of water. The hole we have in the ice is about the size of a big screen TV. Not like a guy that's like way into TV watching, but a big screen TV for a person who watches a fair bit of TV, but not too much.
What's sort of become the norm, I think, for the American household, right? 40 inches.
Yeah, but now and then you walk into a house and you'd be like, these mugs watch a lot of TV.
Oh, right. They're based usually on how big sports fanatics.
Yeah, based on how big that TV is, this guy is watching too much of it. This would be like, we got a hole about the size of, you appreciate TV, you respect it for its value, but you haven't overvalued it. And we're on a slope looking down, 8 feet of water. It's kind of a sandy slope. The slope peters off and some weeds are picking up. And we are spearing for whitefish. There's two species hanging around. We have seen the first one you saw when you dropped that little underwater camera. That was a humpback.
Yeah.
We've seen so far two humpback whitefish and have seen quite a number of round whitefish. They look a lot like a mountain whitefish, if you're familiar with those, and they're about like a smallish mountain whitefish, but not so small that you'd throw it back. But they're a better eating whitefish than the mountain whitefish. And the humpbacks would be like a big lake whitefish. Is that fair, Brant?
Yeah.
So far, we have put two of these whitefish on the ice. And we've also picked up a lake trout and a big burbot, 14-pound burbot. You weighed them out?
14.
A 14-pound burbot. And that's the take so far today, right?
Yeah.
Two whitefish, a big smoking burbot, and then a laker.
Probably the best burbot of the trip.
Oh, yeah, definitely the best burbot of the trip. So
in
that's
the middle
the scene.
Of the day.
Yeah, and it's not even, yeah, and so, yeah, it's the middle of the day. It's what, 1 o'clock now? 2 o'clock?
Yeah, it's still 7 hours till prime time.
7 hours till prime time. Now, I want everyone to introduce themselves and tell your name and how many years you've been ice fishing. Joe?
It's Joe Zech.
How do you spell that?
Z-Y-C-H.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I hadn't caught your last name yet. Joe Zech.
Yep. Most people call him Joe Zerch from work. I don't know where that came from.
Because they just can't live with the Zech. They got to be like, it's got to be Zerch.
Yeah.
Joe Zech. Where'd your grandparents or great grandparents hail from?
Poland.
Oh, I got you. I could see that.
And I've been ice fishing for 28 years, probably.
How old are you?
29.
Oh, okay. Okay, Bryce.
My name's Bryce Myers, and I've only been ice fishing for about 7 or 8 years. Ever since I met Joe, he was the one that took me out for the first time.
Took you under his wing.
Pretty much.
So I'll get to why Joel's ice fished for 28 years, but why, what prevented you from ice fishing the rest of your life?
I'm originally from Boise, Idaho, and not a whole lot of ice down there to fish off of.
So you're like a little south of ice fishing.
Yeah, definitely. I think they do some ice fishing up north, but I wouldn't drive that far to go ice fishing when I was living down there.
So it's not like when you go into a tackle shop in Boise, there's not a You don't see ice fishing gear?
Not that I remember. I don't think so. At least not around the Boise area when I was down there.
But you were an angler.
Yes.
You grew up fishing.
Yes.
Did you grow up hunting?
Not as much. Mostly small game, birds, stuff like that. Not a lot of big game.
And then you became a hard water angler after moving to Alaska.
Yeah, pretty much. Joe said, "You want to go fish one day?" I said, "Sure." Bought a cheap little rod, and after that day, I went out, bought myself an auger, an ice house, and was hooked.
And now here you are with a big pair of ice fishing bibs on, working a tube jig down a hole trying to lure in whitefish.
Yeah.
Okay, Yanni.
Giannis Patelis, and I've been ice fishing for... I could probably still just, instead of saying in years, I can just probably give you the amount of days that I've ice fished.
But I don't understand, why did you not ice fish in Michigan? You guys are the only people I know that hunted and didn't fish.
Dude, I don't know. You'd have to ask my dad that question. And I'm not going to blame my dad, but I'm going to say that they're like it has to do with something with the fact that like my dad just wasn't a big fisherman, never has been, isn't now. It like almost skipped a generation.
But we've talked about this before, right? Yeah. Like anyone who traps hunts and fishes.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone who hunts fishes. Anyone who fishes, who knows what else they do, right?
Yeah.
But like it's weird to meet someone who grew up in a hunting family who didn't fish. Especially in the state of Michigan. But the Lavians probably eat a ton of fish.
Yeah, they do. No, I knew a lot. I mean, we would go out. There was a Kalamazoo Latvian hunting and fishing club. I think my dad belonged to it. And so, yeah, we'd go out and like visit there. They'd have a annual ice fishing derby tournament. We'd go out and check them, you know, meet them, but we never did the fishing.
Okay.
We'd go out there to say hi. So, yeah, less than 10 days on the ice.
Less than 10 days as a hard water angler.
Mm-hmm.
Is that God. Total or is that saying 10 days ago was your first time out?
Total.
Oh.
Yeah, I messed around a little bit last year in Montana.
What are your general impressions?
Oh, I dig it. It's been harder than I thought it was going to be.
Harder physically?
Mostly because I'm bringing kids along. And so I went out there one day to Canyon Ferry. It's blowing 30. And by the time I had the holes drilled, my kids were like, all right.
That's an unbelievably windy place, yeah. Man.
Yeah. Since then, I've had people tell me, like, yeah, if you're going to go out there, you have to have a shack. Unless you catch the right day, you know.
Yeah. I've seen it nice out there, but generally it's, like, windy enough where you're losing 5-gallon buckets.
Right.
Like, you leave a 5-gallon bucket unattended, and all of a sudden it's just gone.
Yeah. Like, no, the ice is scraped almost clean of snow.
You don't get snow on top. Yeah. People come out there. It's so windy that people come out and ice sail, where they make like a little boat that has like basically on skates. Mm-hmm. You ever see this?
Yeah.
That's a windy-ass ice fishing lake right there. Brant?
Brant Mikesell. Ice fishing my whole life.
From the get-go.
From the get-go, yeah.
And then I've been ice. Yeah, I'm 44 years old. I've been ice fishing for 44 years. My mom and dad, I'll point out, for their honeymoon, rented a live-in ice shanty.
That is an awesome honeymoon.
That was their honeymoon. They ice fished for their honeymoon. So, I was even the egg and the mixins that went into producing me. Had a deep familiarity with hard water angling before they even came together and combined to make my component parts. Deep tradition in ice angling. Now, you guys are from, I would say, probably what I think to be like the ice fishingest state.
Minnesota.
Yeah.
I would tend to agree.
I was flying in recently. I was flying into La Crosse, Wisconsin. And on the flight over Minnesota, we passed over some big lakes, and it was right at dusk, and you could see the lake just lit up with lanterns.
There's little ice shanty villages all over.
Ice communities. Do you think it's mostly, like, in a place like Minnesota where people really hit ice fishing heavy, is it because people are miserable and bored in the winter, or do you think it's something else? Like, do you meet people who only ice fish?
Yes, actually.
that they're not generalist anglers.
I mean, I don't think it'd be very common for someone who ice fishes a lot to not open water fish, but there certainly are people that like are dedicated ice fishermen that don't do much open water fishing.
Yeah, and it's like it's more associated with drinking.
It's frequently associated with drinking, but it's also, you know, there's some different styles of people. There's people that love ice fishing that don't really care if they catch anything or if the fishing's good. They more care about the drinking.
Because they want to just go drink on the ice.
Yeah, because it's fun.
Yeah.
But then there's people that, like, want to catch fish and try hard, but they often are drinking too. Not always.
The reason I bring it up is I feel like there's always been a, there's a, like, in the non-ice fishing world, which is a big world, okay, of people that don't ice fish, there's a perception of, like ice fishing has a perception problem.
Grumpy old men.
Yeah, people aren't, yeah, it could be that. You think that did it?
That's what I thought of before I even ice fished.
It's a horrible representation of what it actually is.
Like lazy anglers who aren't successful.
I mean, if you go to those.
Coming in.
Okay, we got a round whitefish coming in.
Bad angle right now.
I think you're just going to have to.
You want me to wing it?
Are you going to let him walk?
I don't know if it's going to turn into the bait.
I got a stroke at him.
Here, take it. Can you get it before?
Not a great stroke.
All right, he might come back.
Yeah.
Doggone it.
Come on.
Come on,
Bryce,
back.
Can you see him still?
Jiggle him, jiggle him, jiggle him.
No, I just watched his tail go away.
Shoot.
He was going back behind us?
Yeah.
Yep, he was kind of like, he wasn't like booking. I wouldn't be surprised if he comes back through.
Seems like he was looking at the jig, but they just like to circle it sometimes.
Oh, man.
I was just thinking we were due. It's been a little bit.
Hold on a minute. No.
Almost excitement. You would have taken that poke, Steve?
Well, I'm in a different spot than you. I would have taken the poke knowing what I now know.
Me too.
But no, I think if I was in your shoes, I would have waited thinking he might hook or just, whatever. But now, yeah, reviewing it in my mind, I would have taken a Hail Mary.
Just one more pass like duck hunting.
Yeah.
Let him get closer.
Exactly. Oh, so anyways, Bryce, the first thing you thought of was that movie Grumpy Old Men?
Yeah, that's exactly what I had in mind for not only Minnesotans, but ice fishermen.
And so,
it's been so long. Real quick, though, refresh my memory. How do they depict the actual angling and the like?
Just a couple of old men sitting around drinking beer and like
not catching shit.
But I feel like most of the movie doesn't actually.
No, it's about one of them's like kind of a little bit putzy, and then there's like a lady, and they both like her. She goes for the one you figure she's going to go for. The other one gets a little pissed.
Start pranking each other, putting fish in each other's trucks.
That's right. That's right. Starting to sound a lot like growing up. So when you got invited out ice fishing, you were like, oh, so this is what I'm getting into? I'm going out, and it's going to be two old men caught in a love triangle?
Not exactly. I mean, I guess I just hadn't really considered going out ice fishing.
Yeah.
I never had the stuff. I wasn't going to just wing it and spend, you know, $300 on an auger or try to chip through the ice with a spud bar or something. But
When you guys first went out, what were you going for?
Oh, it was just the stock fish around Anchorage. The first lake we went to was Beer Can Lake, and just went out and just see what we can catch.
And it wound up being like not exciting.
No, it was very exciting.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, we didn't have any of the Vexlars or any of the fish finders.
Yeah, a Vexlar is like it's a sonar-esque apparatus that kind of tells you what's going down below your hole.
But yeah, so we didn't have any of those, and fishing in the blind, and even then, still, just we caught countless fish, and
they're mostly all dollies, weren't they?
I think so. Yeah, dollies are the stock rainbows.
And then you were hooked.
Oh yeah, right after that, like I said, just went out and started buying ice fishing stuff, and Now I've got my own arsenal.
Because that's what I think. I feel like I was saying, like in the non-ice fishing world, there's this idea that it's like super boring. And I think, because they're looking at people, there's like these different kind of anglers. You have your drunkards. There's three kinds of ice fishing. You had your drunkards. You had your hardcore fishermen that were out to catch fish. And then you had your drunkards who were hardcore fishermen and out to catch fish. And I like associated with, I knew about many of the drunkards. I would see a lot of the people who were out there, but no real interest in catching fish. But it's like the social aspect of it, you know, and like to go drink on the ice. But then in my father's social circle, there happened to be a lot of the drunkards who were hardcore about catching fish. And they would be like, there's like the kind of guy who comes out on the ice. He sets up his shanty without doing any work. He just kind of randomly is out there, drills a hole through the ice, lowers his thing down, and that is where he's going to be.
That's the weekend.
And it's like he's just opening it up to fate. It'll turn out. It won't turn out. Then there's the kind of guy who goes out and drills a dozen holes before he does anything. And you're thinking, this man will be the man that catches fish. Because they're taken to it that same level of devotion and passion that what you'd think like the best open water angler would take to it.
Yeah, and a dozen holes is an understatement. Oh,
yeah.
I mean,
for how many holes do you think we drilled on this lake so far?
Over 100 easy.
You think so?
Yeah.
It takes a lot longer ice fishing when you're trying to find depth changes, because basically if you want to see the depth, you got to drill a hole at every spot.
Yeah, you know, my brother used to talk about the way an ice fisherman perceives the body of water is so much different the way an open water angler perceives it, because he says that he perceives the body of water just basically as like cylinders. Like when you're out on a lake in the open water, you kind of think of the whole lake. But he's like, I just think of it as that I basically drill my hole and I imagine that cylinder extends down to the bottom. And I just think about like that spot. And then I move over and I make like another like theoretical cylinder that I can think about. But you can't be that you're just checking out the whole place, because you're just like picking, you know, you can't troll, you can't cast. You're not like working a drop off. You just have to be where you're like committing to like a specific spot. And picking your spot is really important, but you have a lot less data to go off of to pick your spot, because you're not passing over with a fish finder or getting like a really good sense of where everything is. But Brant, your thing is like drill millions of holes.
Yep, ice troll.
Ice troll. Oftentimes send a camera down there to have a look.
Just check out specific habitat up front, trying to find edges, micro habitat, find the spot on the spot.
And then on top of that, you need to go in there and take a poke. And here we have like the visual element, where we have a big-ass spirit hole and we're in shallow water. So you see all the things that go on that you otherwise wouldn't be aware of. For instance, last night we were jigging for burbot through a hole in the ice where we could actually look down and see, because we put a light so we could look underwater, and had 7 burbot come up to investigate the jig. This is a big predatory fish that like will suck back 6-7 inch fish no problem. 7 of them throughout the course of the night came up and whiffed and sniffed the jig, or passed through under the jig. If you were fishing without the looking hole, you would get the sense that there was no activity and nothing at all going on.
If you have a Vexlar.
Unless you have a Vexlar. Explain the Vexlar.
So Vexlar basically is depth finder, fish finder. If you don't have a camera, which we normally don't have a camera, so we use that to check all the depths, but it basically is a circle, and then it will sound the bottom and have a real dark red line where the bottom is. And then as you jig, your jig's normally like green or
yellow. You can see your jig going up and down.
Yeah, so when you jig, you can watch the light on it go up and down, and then as a fish comes in for like eel pout, they'll come up from the bottom generally, so you'll see a red line come up from the bottom red line and then follow the jig.
It's like a video game, match up the lines and you win.
Yeah.
But the thing about it is like it's like they're very responsive, so it's kind of real time. Like there's a delay with sonar.
Yeah, like a regular boat sonar.
Yeah, where you have a display screen and it's kind of like tracking your history. It's just like a real-time portrayal of what's going on to the point where if you lift your rod to work your jig, you're watching like an exact replication of where your jig's at in the time. There's no delay whatsoever.
Exactly.
But I can't believe like going my whole life and not ever using those things.
I can't believe it either.
Yeah.
I don't know how you like ice fishing. You don't have a Vexilar.
I don't know. I guess I just like it like a deeper old-timey way.
Oh, it's just, you're like, when you're just fishing blind, you never know if there's a fish under you. Like, with the Vexilar, at least you know if there's fish down there or not at all times.
You know, that's a thing that comes up with people griping about technologies like that.
Well, this is a very old-school technology, too. Like, my grandpa had one. So
is that right?
It wasn't colored, but
yeah, my dad had one that was like an LCD screen. It didn't work real well in the cold at all. It was just gray, black and white scale.
But like, you know, but you're familiar with the people that will say, "Oh, it takes all the challenge out of it," right? And I think that like stuff like that can increase effectiveness. But a thing that I always point out to people when having like this conversation about whether it's sonar or whatever else is, you learn a lot more. Like, it enhances your understanding of the environment and what's around you and how it all relates.
Absolutely.
So now that I have this device, like a GPS, now that I have a sonar device when I'm fishing, I can just turn my brain off and now I don't need to learn anything about fish. It's like having a sonar has taught me shitloads about fish. Because you understand like where they are, when they're there and not hitting, when they're there and are hitting. And you come away with it, if you stripped it away from me now, if whatever it became illegal to have it, I would be like, well, thank God for the time that I had with it, because I'd learned so much usable stuff about how fish operate.
Yeah, how to jig, how fast, when they come in and they don't bite, do you go up, make them chase up? Do you go down to the bottom, they'll go down? What size jig's working? It gives you a lot more information. If you don't have a flasher, you're just hoping something bites your jig. And some days that works great. But when you're going into new lakes and finding new territory and want to get something dialed in, it's a good tool.
But there's like
flasher, we should explain, as a synonym for the Vexilar.
Well, Vexilar is a brand name.
Yeah.
Vexilar's brand name?
Yeah.
So when you like when I was younger though, if you were going to strike out to go ice fishing, heading out the door, it would be typically a very like rudimentary setup.
So that was your childhood.
Yeah. So well, no, it depends on to what level we were going out. So like for instance, if we were going out to ice fish the lake you grew up on, you could go as simple as this: you'd have a bucket, and in that bucket you'd have one or two rods. In your pocket, you'd have a chew tin full of maggots. You'd have a little film canister full of jigs. And then if the ice was like 6 inches or less, you'd carry with you a spud to chop a hole. And depending on the air temp, you might not even have a scooper to strain out the ice chunks. And you'd be like out ice fishing like that. Like basically nothing. $20 worth of stuff. Or you'd go out expedition grade fishing where all of a sudden you're introducing, like, we have thousands of dollars worth of stuff with us right now.
Easily.
Oh, yeah.
Just the flashers alone.
Yeah. So, I mean, it can, like, it takes ice angling, takes many different kind of forms, you know? And I think it just kind of winds up being that, like, the level of passion you bring to it or how much you're dying to catch a fish. But out here, you guys are, like, a thing that you guys do in Alaska is different than most people, too, is you kind of do, like, a sort of, like, expedition-ish outing. Like, explain where we are now. You don't have to tell, like, where we are, but sort of, like, talk about what it goes in to get to a place like this and be prepped up for a place like this.
Yeah, so we had several hours on the road, And then about 25-mile snowmobile run into the lake.
Rigged up for everything from start small end of fish up. So spearing whitefish, all that gear, jigging lake trout and burbot, and tip-up fishing for burbot.
Yep.
Now, the ice fish, kind of like a main, I'm going to talk about a little bit about the different apparatuses that people use to catch fish through the ice. Like, as a kid, we would mostly jig for perch and bluegills, or panfish, crappies, perch, bluegills. But then you'd have, like, for big fish, you have this thing called a tip-up. And a tip-up is, what do you guys use the word dead stick for tip-up?
No.
No.
When you guys say dead stick, what's that mean?
It's a rod that's not being jigged.
Just with a piece of bait.
That's your term for a dead stick?
That's
dead
the yeah. term for a dead stick.
What's that?
That's the term for a dead stick.
A rod not being jigged.
Yeah.
Just hanging in the water. Usually next to, like, you'll be jigging a tube jig in one hole, and then you'd have this other rod that just has a piece of bait on it, not moving at all.
And that's your dead stick.
Yeah.
That's a term I hadn't heard. We would just call that, like, a rod over there with some bait on it or something like that. But, like, so a tip-up is, this is what a tip-up is. And there's many different companies that make tip-ups. But a tip-up would be, man, I don't even know where to begin describing a tip-up.
Spool line. That has a spool of line in which a spring-loaded flag holds the line in place until a fish bites. Then the fish can free spool, and the flag goes up, so you know you have a bite. And you can watch it from a distance.
And you take, depending on your area's regulations, like in some lakes, you can put a live fish on the hook. Like,
not in Alaska.
No.
Nowhere in Alaska.
No.
Okay.
You can't use live bait in freshwater at all.
Anywhere in the whole damn state.
Yeah.
Which is weird, because usually, like, rules here are a bit more lax. But, like, in the Midwest, most places you can use live bait.
Mm-hmm.
The argument against, like, what they don't want, when people prohibit live bait, what they're generally trying to prohibit is they're trying to prohibit you purposefully or inadvertently introducing species of fish into bodies of water where they don't belong.
Yep.
So that you would, like, take some suckers or whatever, shiners, suckers, some kind of fish, and you'd catch them out of one lake or buy them somewhere, drive to an area where that fish is not a native fish, and you fish, and you get done, and you dump your bait down the hole, and you just did what they call bucket biology and introduced a new species of fish into an ecosystem where it didn't previously exist. And a lot of fish get moved around that way. And also that you would introduce diseases into waters that you don't normally fish. But, like, growing up Michigan, like, no one's going to set a tip up. No one in their right mind is going to set a tip up in Michigan that doesn't have a live fish on the end. So you rig a live fish, you hook them generally, like, right kind of under the dorsal fin, and you send them down under the water, and you set your tip up. And so you get that thing set to the right depth where you want it. And we used to, you know, we'd fish pike 6 feet off the bottom, however you're going to set it up. And then you position the flag so that when a fish hits the thing and starts pulling line, the flag pops up. And you might be able to set anywhere from 2 to 6 tip-ups out. And you put them all up. Everyone sits around, shuffles around on the ice, talks. A lot of people then begin getting drunk. And then eventually a flag comes up and someone yells, "Flag! Flag!" And you run over there and lift the thing up and then hand line the fish up. And that is, like, because of the unknown factor, that is one of the more exciting things on this planet.
Absolutely. And it's hard to appreciate how fun it is to see a flag pop until you've done it. And once you've done it, you love it. It's just, it's like, there's been times when there's just, like, a flag sitting in one of our sleds. We're not using it, right? But that flag, for whatever reason, is popping up in the air. You just see a flag in the air and that instinct in your body's triggered.
Yeah. That you've developed over a lifetime of waiting for flags to pop.
Yep.
As youngsters, we would sometimes, like, most of the rules on tip-offs are usually this. Varies, but generally it needs to be that you're, like, tending it. Okay, it needs to be your like in your immediate control. How do they word it usually?
Closely attended.
Closely attended, not just attended, but
yeah,
closely attended. Meaning you can't go set them somewhere and then come back the next day to see what you caught. Generally, I'm sure there's exceptions to this, but generally you got to keep an eye on it. So when the ice, when we were kids, we did this now and then. When the ice was good for ice skating, we would be able to set our tip-ups way far apart because you could see them from a long ways away. Then you just would skate around checking them. And it was like kind of like hockey with fish, just moving around chasing tip-ups. But typically you just like set them out, you scatter them kind of out through the ice around your shanty and observe them. And that's tip-up fishing. And what we've been doing at night for burbot, like burbot's a weird fish because I want to cover here, we've been talking about this a whole bunch, but different names. So like, did I already talk about different names for burbot?
No.
Mm-mm.
Okay. The official name is what, Brant?
The scientific name?
Scientific name.
Lota Lota.
Lota Lota?
Yep.
How's it spelled?
L-O-T-A.
Really? Lota Lota. Where you're, like, what you know that fish as might depend a little bit on where you're from. When I first heard of the fish, I heard of it as a ling. But I became suspicious of that name only later when I learned about the saltwater ling cod. But people call them a ling, even though it's a freshwater cod. People will call them an eel pout, which you've heard that in Minnesota?
That's the main term.
Someone told me it's the main term, I think, if you live south of Highway 2.
Yeah, once you get, the first time I ever heard anyone refer to them as lawyers was Lake of the Woods area. So, up, like, getting into closer to Canada, I think that term might have more of Canadian origin.
Yeah, I heard, okay, that's interesting, because my friend Doug Duren, who lives in southwest Wisconsin, he had spent time living in Door Peninsula.
They definitely call them lawyers there.
He says they call them, yeah. He knew that the guys there referred him as lawyers. The first time I ever heard the fish referred to as a lawyer was not far off Door Peninsula, but was fishing out of Garden Peninsula in Michigan's UP, which kind of thumbs down southward. And the guys out on that peninsula call them lawyers. And as he explained to me, he's like, do you want to know why they call it a lawyer? And he opened it up and showed me that its heart sits right next to its vent. Or one might say, like, because he'd say, like, the heart's right close to the asshole. That's how you know it's a lawyer. So that was what they called lawyers. When I first heard of the fish, even though I grew up in a state that has some in the big northern waters, we didn't catch them where we ice fished. We never talked about them. I got to Montana, and they call them ling in Montana. Then I later learned it was burbot. And I learned that some of you boys call them eel pouts. And then there's another word, if you look in fish books, that I haven't heard anybody ever call them, is clench.
Yeah, and on the East Coast, they call them cusk.
Oh, maybe that's it. Didn't we see clench, though?
I've never heard of that.
A cusp?
Cusk.
That's the East Coast?
C-U-S-K, like New Hampshire.
That's what they call them out there.
Yeah.
Either way, if you're from the South and you don't know about this, it's because it's a northern tier fish. It's a fish that's distributed across the North. So,
and around the globe.
And around, oh yeah, Brant, like, yeah, talk about that, Brant. Like, what a circumpolar species.
Yeah, they're circumpolar, so they're on multiple continents across the northern part of the globe.
Other examples of circumpolar critters would be?
Polar bears.
Polar bears. Well, brown bears, grizzly bears. Were circumpolar. The blue mussel is circumpolar. I believe the northern pike, but there's like some variations, but the northern pike is a fish you'll find. Like, so a circumpolar thing would be like, imagine a certain latitude band. If you just take that latitude band and wrap it around the whole earth, you'll find that species are very closely related critters all within that same latitude band wrapped around the whole earth. So it's circumpolar fish. And you were saying, too, that they've been extirpated in places from Europe.
I think there's been areas where they've been overfished in Europe, yeah.
Which is funny, because in Minnesota, where you boys are from, you were saying that a guy might be want to pull a burbot on the ice and leave it laying.
Yeah.
I saw that. We'd have permanent ice shacks on the lacs. And when I was younger, I remember seeing just piles of these things. And no one liked them because they'd leave their rattle reels down at night, and then eel pout would come, bite the line, and then tangle all the lines up when they're trying to fish for walleyes.
Oh, so that's why I didn't like them?
Yeah, well, that's what I think.
They're ugly, and I don't think they're, at least, especially when I was a kid, there was not a reputation for them being good to eat, and I never even tried eating one till I moved to Alaska. There's no walleyes here. You got to ice fish for something. Figured out that not only are burbot fun to catch and much similar to walleye fishing, but they're absolutely delicious.
Yeah, and not just that, but I remember, like, guys that commercial fishermen have an ability in some places where they're like have our commercial whitefish seasons that they'll even be able to market the burbot.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So the tricky part about burbot, the first time I started catching burbot through the ice, in fact, I never caught a burbot not through the ice. But the first place we started doing it, we would go out. There's a lake we'd go fish. We'd go fish for perch during the daytime. And then it'd get to be dusk. And you would have like a narrow window of opportunity around dusk time to set up tip-ups and catch the burbot. Because their bite, like perch, you cannot catch a perch at dark. Like there's some fish that don't want to eat when it's dark out.
Pike.
And some fish that don't want to eat when it's light out. Yeah, pike, the pike bite ends. The perch bite ends. You can get bass to eat at night. Burbot liked to eat at dusk, even though we just caught a tanker at noon today. But you know what I'm saying? Like a general thing, man. General thing. So what we've been doing is going out, and at night, out here on this lake in interior Alaska, setting up tip-ups, which we explained earlier, for burbot. And real quick, can you guys explain like the regs around how many lines you're allowed to use when and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, it varies by water body. In most of the state, you're whatever the daily limit is, you're allowed to put down that many hooks. On any water bodies where it's more, so on pretty much any water body, you can fish two lines for any species of fish through the ice. On places where you're allowed more than to keep more than two burbot in a day, you can have as many hooks down as is the limit, but as soon as you do that, you're only fishing for burbot, so then there's additional regulations about hook size and the bait resting on the bottom and different criteria to try to, I think, limit bycatch of other species.
Yeah, this is the thing that I feel like, we talked about this the other day, it's a thing that's not well understood by people who don't hunt and fish, the like how like tightly regulated and detail-oriented the regulations are around all kinds of like harvest of wild resources. So I'm trying to think of a way to approach like the thing you're talking about with hook size. So like as Brant was saying a minute ago, you can fish when you're ice fishing, just generally ice fishing where you're trying to hope to catch a variety of species, you can fish two rods. The minute you commit that you're only fishing burbot, it's like, okay, now that you've committed to you're only fishing burbot, you can jump up and put five, six.
It depends on the lake. Yeah, on a lot of lakes, it's five a day. In some areas, and some like in rivers, it's 15 a day.
Okay, so let's just say we are in a lake that's five a day. That's an easy number to work with. So all of a sudden, you're like, no, man, I'm only after burbot. So they're like, okay, the regulations basically say to you, okay, since you're only catching burbot, we're going to make sure that you're only catching burbot. At that point, they dictate to you that you have to have a hook with a 3/4 inch gape.
Greater than
3/4 inch gape. And your bait has to be laying on the bottom of the lake.
Resting on the bottom. Yep.
So what they're trying to do there is be like, okay, if you're making a play where you're really just doing this, we're going to allow you to have more lines, but we're going to do added regulations on top of that to prevent, like you said a minute ago, from catch and bycatch. So when we've been setting up at night, we're going out and putting down like enough tip ups where it's hard to keep track how many tip ups you have down. Like where you're kind of wandering around the dark a little bit trying to find them all because the snow's so damn deep. When you dig it out and drill a hole through the ice, your tip up is sort of subsurface and it can vanish on you. And explain what you do, like how you get bait and how you prep your bait for burbot.
We mainly you do a personal use hooligan fisher.
Sorry. I'm going to open the vent.
You getting warm? Should we turn that heater off?
It's off already.
It is off.
Wow, it's that,
is it that warm with
no
heater? I thought someone turned it back on.
Yeah, I'm sweating.
Hold on, let me open this other one too.
Did you pause it?
No.
What were you talking about? Oh, how we get our bait.
Yeah, candlefish and bait.
Yeah, we go out dip netting and
we're not
live right now.
No, we are. Oh, I didn't pause it.
All right, so go ahead.
We dip net our hooligan in the spring and package them. Some of them
you gotta back up and talk about that for a minute, because people have no idea what you're talking about.
They're a smelt. They're some fair number of people are probably familiar with like rainbow smelt in the Great Lakes region. They're also a smelt, but they're larger and oilier. One of their common names is candlefish.
Because you can get so much oil out of them.
Because if you dry them out, you can light them like a candle, which I still haven't tried. Like, I'm not exactly sure which end you're supposed to light, but...
I didn't know that. I thought it was because you could render out oil that was flammable. So you can light the
fish. It's mainly
fish.
That, but you can, from what I understand, you can dry them out and they'll burn, like, for an extended period of time off that oil.
And, like, the... They have two spellings. I'm gathering one must be the kind of official spelling, which is E-U-C-H-A-L-O-N.
Yeah.
Hooligan.
Oh, that's... I don't think it's actually pronounced hooligan. I think it's pronounced Ulican.
Ulican?
Yeah.
But then there's a popularized spelling, which is hooligan like those hooligans who keep vandalizing my car. H-O-O-L-I-G-A-N. Or candlefish. And it's an anadromous fish.
Yep.
Lives out in the ocean, runs up the rivers to spawn, and there's so many that I've never done this. I've done it for rainbow smelt years ago a fair bit. But they're running up so much that you're just dipping blind. You're dipping a net blind into the water.
Yeah, and they spawn in the lower reaches of silty rivers typically.
Like glacial silt?
Right. So they're rivers that you don't really have any visibility in anyways. There's some exceptions to that, but... So it's mainly you're blind dipping, but when it's good, you're getting good numbers in each swipe with the net. And it's just a small, like a bait net, I don't know what, 12 or 14 inch diameter?
Yeah, it's probably about 12, I think.
And you scoop down and go with the basket with the mouth of the net aiming downriver and swipe down.
With the current.
To catch them coming up.
Yep.
Hey, did you ever, when you were growing up, did you guys drop net for smelt?
No. I did very little of that. I didn't really grow up in the Great Lakes area, so.
Oh, really? Oh, nope. Yeah, I guess not. Yeah, you were way far away from the Great Lakes. So, yeah, like fishing rainbow smelt, we would dip net like what Brant's talking about, but usually sight fishing. Now and then you'd have to blind up. Usually you'd have land, or you'd sink a pole. You'd wade out into a stream close to the mouth, or it flowed into the lake, and drive a pole into the mud and hang a lantern from the pole. And you'd wait there in waders, and you'd see the shadows coming by, and you'd dip them like that. Or you'd go out to pier walls and drop a 36-inch by 36-inch square net on the bottom of the lake near the mouth. And when schools would pass over, you'd lift that drop net up.
Oh, cool.
And catch them. And you could, if you had it dialed and had your kind of gear right, adjusted to the sensitivity of the fish, like a lot of times you had to run pretty thin monofilament and have your mesh be the right color where it matched on the bottom, or else they wouldn't go over it. But once you got it dialed, you could catch like extraordinary numbers of smelt like that. Like I was talking about one night, we caught, people catch many more than this, but I remember a night in particular, we caught 8 5-gallon buckets. A rainbow smelt in a
That's
night.
That's a lot of smelt.
And they're very good to eat.
Oh my God, they're good.
Yeah.
But the candlefish or hooligans, they don't have quite the reputation of rainbow smelt.
No, there are people that really like to eat them, but they're oilier and they're larger, so the bones are a little bit more prominent when you're biting into them, and they don't crisp up nice like a rainbow
soggy
smelt.
With oil.
Yeah.
When Danny cooks them, my brother cooks them, he cleans them like a smelt, which you eat them whole. Just take the guts out. He fries them like a smelt, but then he puts them on a cooling rack in his oven that sits over a baking sheet. And then he puts that on 300 degrees and puts them in there for 20, 30 minutes to drip all the oil out. And when you pull that thing out, that baking sheet is full of oil.
Yep.
and then he eats the candlefish. And my wife,
that's a lot of work.
Yeah, my wife will eat anything, man. My wife was like not big into candlefish, but she'll eat. You know what I mean? She's pretty good about stuff.
Yeah, I know the first one I tried to eat, I cut a stick and tried to cook it over a fire, and after gutting it and everything, as it was cooking, all the oil just basically squeezed it right off the stick and fell into the fire.
That greasy.
Yeah. You know, as the meat firmed up, it just squeezed it right off.
So to get back around to the bait, you're primarily, when you go out for hooligans, you're primarily going out for bait, which you use for halibut and everything.
Yep. Yeah, and I mean, herring is a great bait, but there's not as many opportunities to catch it yourself, so you're looking at a lot of money.
Dude, it is so expensive. Yeah, buying herring is expensive, man.
Yep. So this is it's a great bait fish that for residents, there's no limit on that fishery.
Are non-residents allowed to dip hooligans?
No.
Not at all?
Nope, it's a personal use fishery, so it's limited to residents.
Okay, so then walk through how you turn it into burbot bait. This is a pretty elaborate process.
I like to brine my bait. Joe and Bryce like to use more fresh, just frozen.
Natural,
really? Hooligan.
Because you, is it aesthetically or performance?
I don't like getting blue dye all over my hands fishing all day.
I notice Brant's hands are blue.
Or green, whatever the hot color is for the day.
Or red some days.
Yeah.
So you guys are going, you're like taking your candlefish, freezing them in gallon-sized Ziplocs, and I like thawing them out for bait.
Yeah, I like to vacuum seal a bunch just in a single layer until I get sick of doing it, because I think it keeps them fresher and they thaw out quicker.
Yep.
But at some point, you just got to be done with processing them. And
yeah, when you got 15 gallons of that stuff.
15 gallons.
Of hooligan or however much you want. I normally just go with a cooler, like half the size of a regular beer cooler, and I'll fill that up full, and then that's normally good for the year.
And that's how much you need. And yeah. That takes how long?
To net that? 15 minutes sometimes.
Oh, okay. So it could be like hot and heavy.
Oh, yeah.
And it, like, talk about brine and bait for a minute.
So I like to brine bait for a few reasons. One is it helps to firm it up. So yes. Hooligan can be soft. So it's the basic component in a brine is salt that helps to draw moisture out of the meat and firm it up. And then I also like to add various scents and dyes, and mainly because I just don't have that much. I don't get to fish all that often, and there's times when your bait can matter. Often. Well, relatively, like
relative to how much you wish you fish,
right? So I want to make it count when I go out.
Yeah, no, I got you. But you're not a half-asser.
Nope. And if there's any little thing that might help you catch a couple more on a given day, I like to try it.
So you're using salt to firm the thing up, and then you can buy like commercially produced like bait enhancements.
Yeah, you can buy commercially produced brines that already have a dye in them, or you can make, there's different recipes with adding different things into your brine to do the firmness, and then so you can make your own brine with your own materials, which is usually like salt and powdered milk and water, and then you can add herring oil or dye, turn it whatever color you want, or buy the stuff that's already made up commercially.
Now, have you been brining halibut bait too?
I have. I started doing that.
Because I had to salt brine it, but I never do any of the other stuff to it.
So what I like to do is brine it in a liquid brine and then drain it off the liquid and then put just straight salt on it. And that'll help keep it firm and keep it from freezing, which when you're out ice fishing, it's annoying when your bait's freezing.
Yes.
You use a rock salt or just regular, like, table salt?
I actually use table salt. At your cabin, Steve, we usually use rock salt, yeah. But I think that the finer salt helps to coat it better.
Yeah.
More surface area.
So these hooligans then are blue, can be red, can be normal.
I see whitefish, yeah, but he's already gone.
He's already gone?
Well, I mean, he kind of came into the zone just enough so I could see him. And
where'd he come from, the deep?
Yeah. Just did a 180 back in
Man,
there.
Why are they like changing their attitude so much lately? We're in a real suck stretch here, man.
We're due.
Yeah, but they're just not coming in and lingering. Little pass-throughs.
Well, at least we know they're around still.
You know what I was talking about TV earlier? It'd be like if you were watching TV, and just now and then the program flickered on. Right? And then it flickered off again. That's what this is like. And it flickers on, and you're like, there's like a action scene happening. And then it flickers off. You're like, oh, man, what happened? Heartbreaking. So catching Burbitt now. Do you? How convinced are you that Burbitt liked to be down deep? I'm real convinced of that. But that you think that the evening, the low light triggers a Burbitt, he's going to come up and hunt the shallows.
Yep, come up. Spend the daylight not moving around, not being very active in deep water, and then coming up in the shallow flats to chase bait fish and feed. They're a bottom. They relate to the bottom. They kind of have that rough fish look to them, maybe like a catfish. So you could see how there'd be a perception that they're like this lazy, scavenging bottom feeder fish.
Yeah.
Which is possibly another reason, you know, slimy bottom feeder, why they get that nickname lawyer. But they they feed mainly on live fish, and
it's like the kind of lawyer who has a billboard in Las Vegas. In a fight, call me.
But they're very aggressive. So except for last night, I guess under our hole, they weren't very aggressive.
We found seven that were not at all aggressive. They were curious but not aggressive. So it seems like a kind of like an unassailable truth that Burbitt liked to live down deep during the daylight hours, and then as the sun goes down, they come up shallow to hunt. Like, do you feel that's pretty true?
Yeah, I think that's pretty standard in lakes in particular.
In lakes in particular. So what we do is, to fish them, you're going out and at dusk, setting up your tip-ups in. The deepest we've been running has been
15 feet, 20 feet.
15, 20 feet of water. Up to as shallow as where that fish has to be bumping his head on the ice as he swims around.
You wouldn't really think there's enough room for it to fit under there.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, literally, a gap of 12 or 16 inches between the bottom of the ice and the mud. And you have a bait laying there, and there's fish that are swimming around in that narrow gap of free water hunting. Or spurting eggs. Because it's like the spawn time of year. And you set them all up, and then you either get like wham bam or just the stillness.
Yeah, we've seen both.
So the first night we set up, by the end of the night we had
10.
10 Burbitt?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Big fish. From what to what inches? Well, the top end would be 14 pounds, is the biggest so far. The small end would be what, like 3 or 4 pounds?
Nah, maybe about that.
Oh, there you're going.
Oh, whitefish?
Yeah.
Oh, skirting the edge. What is he doing up there?
Come on.
Lure him down.
See, I think we got to move.
No. Move to where?
No, I think we got to move the jig away from the spear hole, so when they skirt the edge, they come under us.
I completely disagree. Because we've had somebody come up. We've had somebody come up to smell the thing.
Not for the last couple hours.
Yeah, I don't know.
Think about it like this, Brant. Let's say, okay, I want to just to bring you into the debate here. We have an attractant. Basically, we just have like a rig that you would use to catch a whitefish.
A little jig.
What's that?
A little jig.
Yeah, we have a little jig with a little flasher above it, and a little jig is tipped with a wax worm, and we're jigging it in the center of the big spearing hole. And we've had quite a number of whitefish literally come up to the thing. Oddly, not bite it, but just come up to it and put their nose against it. Some come under it. Some come along to the side. But it seems to be the last couple have kind of skirted around the edge. Brant thinks that we would go drill a hole.
There's one right there.
Yep, that's him coming back.
You got to angle
side him? Shoot it?
I might side shoot him because he's not playing not playing ball with us.
Oh, this is going to be a tough shot.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Well, he's still.
Is he going to come back?
He's just holding tight. Oh. He's just standing there. Or not standing. You know what I mean?
Like if a fish could stand, he'd be standing?
Yeah. Hold on a minute.
Can you see him still?
Do you still see him?
Yeah, I still see him.
Is he looking this way?
He's like right underneath you, Brant.
He's just messing around right up in the zone.
Is he coming in?
Not quite.
Do you still see him?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, he's right there.
Try going down to the bottom with the jig.
Oh, I was going to say lift the jig all the way to the surface.
One or the other.
Yeah, try that. Just for a minute.
He's going to come right up to the hole.
I don't see him anymore. Oh, my gosh. I've never seen that in all my years of ice fishing.
What's the fish doing now?
He went away.
He'll be back.
I'm going to laugh if he comes and eats that waxy that's floating down there. No,
I hope he does. That's a nice natural presentation.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
So it's going for?
So Brant is suggesting, since they seem to be skirting the edge, he's suggesting going and drilling a hole over yonder, thinking that as they skirt the edge, it'll bring them right below the spear hole. I feel it would just make it to be that when fish are investigating it, there's so much more out of sight. Where is he now? Same lower zone? Oh, I see him. Here, you know what?
He's going to take a shot.
He's coming in.
I might go for him. Oh, you want to try him, Brant? Did he spook?
He might.
I don't think he would have spooked. Here, hold that again. Because he was at least up against the bottom there, which makes him like a little bit more pinnable.
I'm not saying like put it far away, and maybe even if we just put it like 3 feet away, we'd still be able to see it. But it would let them, you know, they're kind of staying like 5 feet away from it.
Except for the ones that come up and smell it. Or the ones that come up underneath it.
Right, but that hasn't been happening lately.
What was I talking about?
How my idea is horrible.
Yeah, but even before that.
Burbot coming up. Shallow to feed.
Oh, so yeah. So you can like lay by like a considerable bunch of poundage on burbot meat. And the thing about a burbot, it looks like, we didn't really get into what they look like. I think it looks like a frog and a snake made love. Where you have a very bull, it's fishy for sure. It's like indisputably fishy, but has bullfrog qualities to the head. And the body is that of a, like an eel-like, snake-like body. Covered in...
Definitely snakehead-ish.
Snakehead-ish?
Don't you think?
Yeah.
When you feel them, they're not snakehead-ish, but I think if you just looked at two pictures of the two fish...
Yep. Oh, you mean like not a snake's head, but a snakehead fish.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
They have some similarities with like a bow fin, too.
Yep, and they got that fin. Like the dorsal fin runs down the whole length of the thing. And then he's got like a bottom. What fin do you think it is on the bottom?
The caudal fin.
The caudal fin is basically along his entire bottom. He also looks like a bowfin. You know that fish?
Yeah, dogfish.
Dogfish or bowfin. A lot in common appearance with a bowfin, but flesh-wise, dramatically better. And they're covered in frog skin.
Yeah, slimy.
Slimy skin, like cats, like... More of a froggish skin than you'd find on, say, a catfish. When you go to clean a burbot, you can just make a cut through the skin and peel the skin off with a pair of pliers. And then you got all the tail meat. So from the vent back, you can just kind of flay it off like a flay. From the vent forward, you're peeling off big back straps, kind of. And the ribs are weird because the ribs, don't curve down, but just kind of go straight out. So you're actually flaying off like a sizable chunk of meat. And the way that you always hear it described is it's described as poor man's lobster. Oh, whitefish, right underneath you. Right underneath you.
No jig down the
hole. I cannot see it.
Here. You'll find him.
Oh, all right.
You got him?
Yep. Should I take this? This is a risky shot. Do you think he's going to turn around?
I would do it.
All right.
Way behind him.
Damn.
That's a tough shot.
Yeah. That was a tough shot. Kind of getting out of the... Oh, you got to be kidding me.
Who tied that knot?
I did.
Double damn.
Someone's going swimming.
You know, earlier I was naming off all the names that there are for burbot, which is endlessly fascinating to me. But when we were naming names off, did some people call it poor man's lobster?
No.
I didn't talk about that.
No.
The reason folks call it poor man's lobster is because a sort of the preferred way to eat burbot is to prepare it like lobster, where you take the meat and boil it like you're doing a lobster boil, dip it in melted butter, and just eat it boiled. But a thing that I can't figure out is that you've been to salmon boils and other kind of fish boils.
Yeah.
Like, do you think that the burbot, like let's say I took a chunk of walleye and a chunk of burbot and boiled them both, do you feel that you would eat the burbot and be like, man, that is better suited to this preparation than walleye?
I've often wondered that because there's not really many fish species that you cook like that. Just drop it in boiling water for a minute in pieces. It does have a distinct lobster like texture and flavor.
You feel like it full on does.
Oh, it does. Yeah. It
tastes I don't know that he goes, we eat them that way, but I don't know why we eat them that way. He's like, I just eat them that way cuz they're called poor man's lobster.
Oh, I think they taste like a saltwater fish more than a freshwater fish.
Yeah. So you feel that's I'm definitely like that's how I think about cooking them for sure, man. Do you guys fry them too though? I've never fried one in my life.
Yeah, I've fried them. Usually I just don't have that much, so it's a bit of a novelty, and so it's just cool to cut them up into little. They're like when you cross cut those back straps, it's like little scallops, and then drop those in the salty boiling water quick, and dip them in butter. And I mean it's cool, and it's like rarely have people that you're serving it to ever had it or heard of a burbot before. So
yeah. Our friend Randy was saying that burbots were so despised where he grew up in Minnesota among walleye fishermen that if you caught a burbot, people would go drill a new hole as though the hole had been tainted by the presence of that fish. But like, and walleye are good, but I feel like people like think walleye are better than they actually are. Like, there's a lot of fish that are as good as walleye.
Yeah, you're not going to get any... In a fish house full of Minnesotans, no one's going to agree with you on that one, but...
Like, they feel like the walleye is just, like, absolutely good.
Yeah.
I think what people like when they like walleye is walleye don't have any muddy taste. You don't need to, like, do any extra kind of trimming, and it's just clean, white, benign, right? It's the halibut of the fresh water.
Yeah.
Meaning it's, like, it's a blank slate. There's no
fish.
Oh, nice one.
Oh, that's a good one. See ya.
Okay. The cord's
fine. I got you.
That's not good.
No, but it didn't spook him somehow.
Podcast cord went into the spirit.
Man, he's kind of out of my zone, though.
Steve's going down. He's got the spear 3 to 4 feet in. Threw it.
I think I hit him.
I think you got him.
Did you really? Yeah, it was a cockeyed shot.
Yep.
Oh, he's on there.
All right, pull him up.
Nice work.
That was an impressive shot. Holy mackerel.
Oh, that's how we do it.
Careful.
There we go.
Got him.
That was impressive.
That is impressive. Underneath us.
Yeah, that was like See, my sports analogies, they're so dated. I feel like that was like Larry Bird, right?
That was like a trick shot.
There we go.
That's impressive. Here you go. Throw them outside. Starting to get decent number of those.
Nice, nice, nice. So what happened there was the embracer. Bryce the embracer. You feel like you sucked him in? Do you feel like you're in the driver's seat right now?
Sometimes, but then again, I can't tell if I'm bringing them in or spooking them away.
So you don't like you're not getting the sense that like you're that they're coming like eyeballing that thing.
Some of them do, but some of them just don't really seem to care.
Yeah.
About what I'm doing here.
But why are they showing up then? Here's what I'd like to know more than anything. If you let's say all of us each had a hole like this, would we all be seeing about
the same?
Yeah, is it just like a total random distribution of fish that happen to be passing through? Or are we creating a little micro environment, you know, with the jig and the light difference? I guess it probably doesn't look too... No, it has looked different from their perspective.
Either way,
what just happened is whitefish came in, was a little bit noncommittal. A lot of guys are thinking, you know, Steve, he's a great man. I don't think he can pull this off. I think he's finally met his match, and in the end, I came through.
That fish was far enough underneath us that I could not see it. Steve was leaning over the hole, looking under us, and throwing backwards, and I couldn't even see the fish, nor that the spear stuck it, is how far under us it was.
Yep.
It was like a shot from 10 feet behind the three-point line.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. 11 feet. Where were we? So, Ahmet, that little bit of action there. Where were we?
We're talking about eating
relative.
Walleyes.
I was saying that a walleye, and this is not to bash on walleyes. I like everything about walleye. I like catching them, looking at them, love eating them. But I was saying it's kind of like a halibut type fish where it's sort of a blank slate. It's like white flesh, flakes nice. Clean tasting, you can kind of do anything with it. No one's going to eat it and be offended by it, you know.
But I feel like walleye to me, I don't know, you guys should describe it. You guys have probably eaten more of them than I have.
I have never had walleye before in my life.
Oh, well,
I've really? Never even caught walleye.
Oh, that's
or
right.
Seen
There's
walleye.
Only two Minnesotans
because there's not a walleye in Alaska.
No,
or I don't know if they're in Idaho or
there's
not.
There's damn sure a lot of
definitely
walleye
not where
in
I was
Idaho.
Fishing
in the reservoir systems.
Being a Minnesotan and eating a lot of walleye, I think it's what it tasted like. Because to me, the little that I've eaten it, when I taste it, I don't taste to me. And you know, if you're a lover of halibut, don't get mad at me. But to me, it's a little on the bland side. It's such a blank slate. Where walleye, there is some flavor there. There's a sweetness maybe to it.
I agree, sweetness.
You feel that walleye has more flavor than halibut?
Definitely.
And I think it has a better consistency.
I think you'd rather have a pound of walleye than a pound of halibut.
Any day.
I would too.
Really? I mean, I don't know that I wouldn't. But I think if you went and polled most Americans, they're just not going to agree with that. But Brant, give your take on what walleye tastes like.
I think Yana summed it up pretty good. I think they're mild, so they don't have a fishy taste. They don't have a strong flavor at all. They can take on whatever seasonings you want to flavor them with, but they have a bit of a sweetness and they're firm. And as opposed to halibut, that can get if you cook it like a touch too long, it can get a little dry or even kind of threaded like chicken can.
Yes.
Whereas walleye, oh, fish straight down.
Yeah.
Get him, Yannis.
At the jig. Come on, eagle.
Nice round one.
Come on, eagle.
Oh, nice.
Over his
nose? Nice. Right in
the head. Yeah, lift up gentle.
Oh.
I mean, you got him.
Yep, and then swing this way. Nice shot.
With your reactions.
Oh, no. That
was excitement.
I wouldn't say oh, about a miss.
Oh, look at that. I think I got him on the
nose.
Right in the nose.
Nice shot.
top
look,
lip.
You stoned him. Look at, he's out. He's not even flapping his tail.
Yeah, bring him up. Yep, there you go.
Oh man.
That's a beautiful shot.
Through the brain.
Giannis, the plug, Putellis, man. Nice shot. Nice shot. Man.
Okay. First one, we'll chalk it up to luck.
Giannis is batting 1,000 lifetime spearfishes.
Next time we see Giannis, he's going to have a hat that says the Dark House on it. Nice shot. Okay. Back to
walleyes.
Because we're going to get to whitefish edibility soon, very soon.
Joe, do you have any thoughts on the flavor of walleye?
No, I mean, like Steve was saying, most people would probably prefer halibut over walleye, but I'm with Brant. I like the walleye more, and I don't know if that's because it's not as readily available to us up here or if it's because I just like the texture better.
You mean because in Alaska you can't turn around without bumping into a halibut?
Yeah.
Or a bag of halibut fillets?
Yeah, so along that lines and how it matters what's most abundant. So when I was back in Minnesota ice fishing with buddies this winter, I brought, you know, halibut to share with everyone and salmon. And none of my Minnesota buddies who catch walleyes all the time, they all thought I was crazy saying that I like walleye better than halibut. They say, oh, halibut's better 10 times out of 10.
Because they don't have it, it's different.
But they have a freezer full of walleye, yeah.
When I say that a fish is approachable, or like people like it and it's a blank slate, what I mean is this, is like, okay, take a fish like mackerel, okay? For a lot of people, it's too oily, too dark, too strong flavored. But there are people who are going to like know how to cook it and wind up loving it so much that it makes up for the detractors. And I think with halibut or walleye, it'd be like there's people who kind of like, I don't generally like fish. Like, I'm not a fish person, but I like walleye. I'm not a fish person, but I like halibut because it's just a kind of a, and I'm not talking down on it or being mean about it, but I'm saying it's kind of a safe, mild, like it doesn't inspire a lot of, it doesn't inspire a ton of love and it doesn't inspire a ton of hate. Except for it inspires a lot of love.
True, and I think burbot falls right into that same category.
It meaning what?
A mild white meat that isn't strong but has a good natural flavor.
Yeah, and a good texture.
And a good texture.
With whitefish, see...
Oh, hold on. Can I add something to this whole poor man's lobster?
Oh, yeah, poor man's lobster.
When I was working at Old Tuscanini in Beaver Creek, Colorado.
That's where he got the name Long Tong Yanni.
Because he
manned the long tongs at the Tuscanini.
Over
right?
The old grill station.
Working the grill, and he had a set of long tongs and Long Tong Yanni. Now they call him the plug.
We'd bring in a fish called a monkfish. And that was also...
That's got a good liver.
Referred to as poor man's lobster.
It and was?
Yep.
Cooked the same fish? Way?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Monkfish liver or monkfish flesh?
Monkfish.
I never heard that.
And again, I have...
I don't fit. You know, it's like I don't fish for them, so we don't talk about them as much. But that's just... Yeah, I had never heard that before. Hey, Brant, can you touch on... can you touch on burbot liver? Kind of like... Start out by how they have a gigantic liver and proceed from there?
Yeah, so everyone's familiar with cod liver oil, right? And so, as we've talked about, burbot are the only species of freshwater cod, so they have the same trait of a very large and oily or fatty liver that it can be cooked in a few ways. I think it's a delicacy in some places. I think... in France, I think burbot liver is popular.
Freshwater burbot liver. Or, of course, freshwater. But, yeah, freshwater fish liver.
And so I've just recently started doing this as I learned about it. But
I've had. Did you do this because you heard about burbot liver eating, or just because you're like, well, hey, it's got a big liver like a cod, I'm going to try to cook it?
I actually, because I heard about it as burbot, okay. And it was introduced as, well, it's a cod, so it's similar.
Yep, I got you.
But the way that I've done it the last couple of years is just sliced thin and then drop it in an ungreased frying pan and that.
Like a dry pan.
A dry pan, and that, there's so much oil in that liver, it'll just create its own grease, it'll render out, and then you're basically just frying it in its own oil. And it'll crisp up real nice on both sides. So you're just kind of zapping it once you get oil in there. And you don't want to overheat that oil, because I made that mistake and it smells fairly bad. But when you just brown it, it kind of crisps up and it's not gamey at all. Like, it's a real nice flavor. And just add a little bit of salt.
And it's good.
It's good, yeah.
Do you ever drink the oil afterward, or is that too strong?
I have not. That oil has definitely some flavor to it.
That reminds me of two fish oil stories. Years ago, I was down in, you know, the species of Asiatic carp that have gotten into the Mississippi drainage?
Yeah,
big head. Well, there's like several. So there's big head.
Silver.
That's kind of the primary ones. The flying carp being the silvers, and there's another one, big head carp. And these are carp that they were using to clean aquaculture facilities. So these are like herbivorous carp. Filter feeding carp that they would put in these aquaculture facilities where they're raising catfish or tilapia. And they'd use the carp to maintain the tanks. And during flooding, the aquaculture facilities would be like overrun with water. The carp escape and get out into the main stem river channel. And now they're all over. And in some of these stretches of river, the primary biomass of fish in these rivers is these carp. So there's been a lot of brouhaha about what to do with them. And there are some commercial fishermen that are operating up and down the Ohio and Mississippi rivers. And I think some other branches of it as well, netting these carp up. And they're sending them overseas to Israel for gefilte fish and various other processed fish preparations. And people for a while were thinking, oh, if we could just catch them all, we'll take care of the problem. And so they would set requirements where they want to be able to catch all the carp out, but not destroy the game fish. So they would come out and say, like, okay, you can use a whatever inch mesh net. You can use a 4-inch mesh net to catch carp, thinking that your game fish can be small enough to fit through the mesh. And they could go into these areas and pretty much remove in very specific areas, in certain situations, they could go in and put a real dent on the large introduced carp. But what they would find then is you would still have the same poundage of carp in the watershed. It would just be the poundage would be comprised of much smaller fish rather than much larger fish. It's just this ongoing problem, and if you want to go read about it, you can go read about all the different thoughts in it. One of the most pressing issues around these introduced carp species is that they will get up into the Great Lakes watershed. Now, you know, of course, the Ohio, Missouri, Mississippi, Tennessee, right? These all wind up flowing into the Mississippi.
Fish.
Oh, yep.
Got them. Oh, spooked.
What spooked them?
The jig.
Just too aggressive.
You drop it on the ground?
Yeah, I was starting to pick it up again, and then you guys started yelling fish, so I tried to set it on the bottom.
Yeah, do you mind tending that line a little bit for me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Maybe just hang it there and just stop jigging it.
I don't know, man. I kind of like that. I don't know. I feel like you...
When the fish comes in.
Oh, when he comes in?
Yeah, instead of just dropping it to the ground, like a quick movement.
Instead of scaring the bejeevas out of him? So... I'm off on a little bit of a side note here, but it's going to continue for a minute. Because a big fear about these Asiatic carp that have invaded the Mississippi drainage areas.
Straight down.
Is that another one?
That's a different one.
That's a bad angle. I might wait. Oh, now he's not even a contender anymore.
I have a shot at him.
Do you?
Yep.
Take it.
Will you man that line?
Yeah, you're good.
That's a big angle. Oh, he's right below us now.
Oh.
Definitely dodged that one.
He dodged it, didn't he?
Yeah, that one was skedaddling as that thing was coming down.
He moved?
It sure seemed like it.
Holy mackerel. I thought I had him. Who's up? Giannis is up.
No, I'm up.
No, you're Steve.
Oh, that's right. I stole that from you.
So a fear with these Asiatic carp species that have gone and invaded this river system is that they would get into the Great Lakes. And what I was saying is, like, so the Tennessee, Ohio, Missouri, like, everything flows in the Mississippi. The river that the writer Ben Metcalf calls the American heartworm, and flows out into the Gulf of Mexico, you know, in New Orleans, around New Orleans. So the Great Lakes, that whole system flows out through the St. Lawrence Seaway into the Atlantic. But years ago, they made a shipping canal to connect the Great Lakes watershed to the Mississippi watershed. So you can now do what you would not have been able to do, you know, 100 years ago. Or, do you know when they dug that canal?
I don't.
200 years ago. I don't want to mess that up. 200 years ago, you'd not have been able to go up the Mississippi and then finagle your way into the Great Lakes, those different watersheds. But they made an artificial connecting point. And they're afraid that these carp that are now in this river and the Mississippi drainage will make the jump by going through this shipping canal and invading the Great Lakes. And what they've done to prevent this from happening is the Army Corps of Engineers runs an electro barrier. So there's a bunch of water there that they have, like an electrified water that's meant to prevent fish from wanting to cross that barrier. And that's what's that?
I said, no shit.
Yeah, that's what they have to keep. That's what they installed to keep these carp from coming in and invading the Great Lakes. So there's been a real thing, like, what are we going to do with all these damn carp? So people have been kicking around different ideas of how to make it marketable. And this guy had built this facility where he was going to start, you know how everybody's always talking about eating omega-3 fatty acids? Mm-hmm. People like cod liver oil. It's you can extract fat from these carp. So I went to visit this little mobile processing facility that he was beginning to test out, and he wanted to get, I think it was like FDA approval, to be able to make this carp oil and put it in pill form. And I go down there to see his facility, and he's showing me, he's got like a bottle of oil that he's extracted from these carp. And you smell it, it smells just like cod liver pills, cod liver oil. And I have a little sip of it, and it was like pretty peppery and like very cod liver oily. And they go and investigate this little like centrifuge type machine he's using to make this stuff. You couldn't have fit another maggot in that thing, man. And I remember being like just kind of turned off because I felt a little bit like I'd been duped into eating maggot oil.
Mm.
I mean, it was just like he hadn't been cleaning the thing. It was the nastiest thing. I don't know if that guy ever got it off the ground. But that was like a weird case scenario with that stuff. But the other thing that was not weird, Yanni, do you remember up on Nunavak Island when we were fishing tomcod through the ice?
Yes.
Do you remember eating those livers?
Yep.
Dipped in seal oil?
Mm-hmm.
That was not bad.
No. We ate those raw.
Yeah. So the Eskimo of Nunavak like tomcod liver, which is probably another one that's very similar, but a very small fish. So we've covered burbot up and down on Eaton. I want to now touch on Eaton whitefish. And this is like a one where they're not all universally appreciated because people have the same, from a table fare stance, people kind of have a similar perspective with mountain whitefish, which is the whitefish that live in, like, you know, anyone who's fished the West knows them as being a fish of the trout streams. But whereas rainbow trout, if you're fishing in the Rockies and you catch a rainbow trout, that's a non-native fish that's been introduced into that system by, you know, out of barrels, unless you're on the Pacific slope. If you're on the Pacific slope, you can have native rainbows. But anything that flows east, absolutely, you're fishing a non-native fish species. When you're fishing brown trout, you're fishing a non-native species. That's a European trout. So when people think they're in some pristine Western thing catching brown trout and rainbow trout, you're catching fish that got dumped into the place out of a barrel. It's basically like, it's kind of like it's a little bit of a make-believe fish. But living there alongside them is mountain whitefish, which looks strikingly similar to the round fish that we're eating here and or catching here. And mountain whitefish are like a lot of people don't like them. Like all the trout fishing you've done, Giannis, what has been sort of your general take on what people think of mountain whitefish?
Oh, they treat them like those Minnesotans treat the eel pout. I mean, I've seen guys just give them the death squeeze and act like they release them. They give them the death squeeze, throw them on the bank so the birds eat them. I mean, just no respect at all.
When people
I never
do that,
heard
are they
anybody
think,
eating them until I talked to you.
When they do that, are they thinking that it's going to make more room for more non-native fish by getting rid of that fish?
Yes.
Like they don't want them competing with they don't want the natives competing with the non-native
fish.
Oh,
yeah. They don't, yeah, well, they don't, yeah, the sport fish, the ones that jump, right?
Yeah.
The suckers get the same treatment.
Yeah. We started eating them because we would take them and brine them and smoke them and make like whitefish dip out of them. Chef Eduardo Garcia smokes them and puts them in empanadas.
Fish.
Yep. Little dinker, too.
He came in hot.
Yeah, he came in hot and crazy. I'm not even going to get ready for him. He looked like he was running from a big burbot.
Did he come and go?
He just came in. Like
he never even slowed down.
That was just a pass-through, man. Yanni, can you tend the line for me?
Yeah, I got it.
Well, it's under your boot right now. So that's how
you're good.
So that's kind of like the mountain whitefish, which I think is a pretty good fish. But it's weird because there's so much variability in whitefish. So like in the Great Lakes, you have the lake whitefish, which has a commercial market. That is like a phenomenal fish. Very white texture, but it's bony, and you got to debone it. Here, I think that
you can cut a full-on fillet off of it.
You can cut a full-on fillet. Yeah, you can go in and take a lake whitefish, which are highly respected. So in the Great Lakes, lake whitefish are as easily as esteemed as walleye, perhaps more so. And there's a limited, the Chippewa hold some commercial license where they use trap nets to catch lake whitefish. And then they market the caviar as well. And they catch some big-ass burbot as bycatch in those trap nets. But other people target them, and they have a really good reputation. You can fillet them, but you have one line of pin bones that you got to remove on a whitefish. But, yeah, they're excellent. Fried as sandwiches. They export them, eat them in Europe. Good fish. Up here, this is like they use a lot of them to feed dogs and stuff. That's not true?
Oh, I don't honestly know. I think that historically, whitefish were an important source of food, primarily in the winter because it was a fish that was catchable in the winter, and I believe
with
it
nets.
Was used as dog food, but with nets or traps.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how much whitefish is used as dog food now.
Just because people don't run sled dogs and stuff as much anymore.
I mean, there's areas where people do. I know that there's, you know, certainly some fish is used to feed dogs. And I think there's people that use whitefish for it.
Yeah. What's the general, like in Alaska, what's the general reception of the of whitefish's table fare in Alaska?
I think it's a little bit unknown. I mean, I think, for one thing, I think whitefish is kind of overshadowed by all the other great tasting fish we have. And as far as like the sport side of things, there's just not that many people that get after it for whitefish. There's some personal use or subsistence fisheries, like in the Chattanooga, you can spear them as they're spawning in the fall.
Okay. And people go do that?
People do that. And there's some subsistence netting in some parts of the state for whitefish. Oh, huge burbot. Huge burbot.
Holy mackerel. Cow.
Jig that.
Was he paying attention?
He didn't. He wasn't. He was moving. That was a big fish. Holy cow.
I didn't even see it.
Yeah, he went right under you, Bryce.
Was it as big as that 14-pounder?
Pretty close.
It was in that.
Really?
It was in that size class.
Definitely.
No way.
That was cool.
Oh, man. I wish I'd have seen it.
They're out cruising our edge that we're set up on. What's that?
I have that bourbon.
You got him on, Dirt?
Yeah. He's just killing it with that stuff.
Open that window up. Oh, you got him on. You got him filmed. He's got, he's got him on.
He's got him on the hook.
Oh, nice job, Dirt.
How big is it? Were we right or were it's we exaggerating? Nice
one. You're exaggerating, but it's a dandy.
Holy
you
mackerel.
You jigged him up, Dirt. Yeah, he went right past the
camera, too. So you don't need a flasher.
See, or is he using all that talk about Vexies.
I don't know.
Good job, Dirt. That's a giant.
Oh, we're in here working. Garrett's out there just fishing.
So, so you were like, had a camera aiming down, making pretty pictures, as is your job, and you were fishing, which is not your job, and all of a sudden, whammo, there he was. Well, the fishing was part of my job, because I'm trying to come this way if they pass the guy's
spear.
That's
good work.
Do you guys feel that when he went by that he was headed to hit that? Like he had a mission?
He was on a line to that jig. Yeah, because I went jigging when that all went. You stole that fish from us.
That's a nice fish, man. That's probably like a, what, like a 12-pound burbot.
Eight.
So you went out and looked at him? So he's not even close to the 14er.
Very nice.
Dirt Miff. Nice work. Nice work. Laying by some meals. All right, shut the windows.
Back to spearing.
Get the dark house back in action. You guys not want me jigging that? Oh, no. What are you talking about, man?
Keep jigging.
Keep stacking them up.
Uh-oh.
We'll be able to snag it up. So there's a book I'm reading right now called The Land of Feast and Famine. And it's about fur trappers who were working around Great Slave Lake in the, I think in the 30s, the 20s, late 20s. And man, for their, like, because these are guys that had, are traveling by canoe, and they had to carry their sled dogs with them in the canoe because they're traveling into the trapping grounds. And then when everything freezes up, they make sleds and the dogs pull the sleds. So they spend most of their time in the summertime fishing whitefish with nets to keep, you know, the dogs fed every night. And then when it starts to freeze up in the winter, when they know they can keep fish frozen, then they just net whitefish in order to feed the dogs throughout the winter, in order to feed themselves throughout the winter, and also to use some for trapping bait. And these guys will go, in this book, they talk about periods where they're going literally months eating nothing but whitefish cooked on a spit over a fire. And the intense cravings that you would get living that lifestyle. But he would say that the thing, you could get over, like Stephenson talks about this too, is like you can get over salt. Like the, our taste for salt is an acquired taste. And you say when you go months and months with no salt, you lose that feeling of wishing you had salt on your meat. And when Stephenson would travel into the village, like Eskimo villages, they would just make sure to put, because they were always worried about everyone eating their food, and they would put extra salt on their food because they know that the people who didn't use salt would never be able to eat even moderately salted food. And it was a way to make your food unpalatable to people, was to put a little bit of salt on it.
Hmm.
Like, it's that level of acquired.
Really?
But this guy that was living for months on just whitefish, their cravings would be for red meat. And like that would be the thing that they wish they had and would wait and wait for, was to get caribou, because it would offset like how off you felt just eating nothing but whitefish. But the way I'll be cooking these whitefish we're catching right now is just brine them whole and smoke them.
Yep.
It's because it's the perfect fish for it. It's oily. It's like a little bit bony, but when you smoke it, it loosens the flesh up so you can peel the flesh off. And it leaves a skeleton that looks like something you could put like in a museum display. Like something Sylvester the cat would be walking around. Like you just like the meat peels away and you have like the perfect little skeleton. All I do is like I slit them up from the belly to the chin, take out the guts, cut the gills out, but leave the head on. truss them by putting a little string around the back of their neck, under their gill cover, out their mouth, and tie a loop in it, and just hang them in the smoke or smoke like that. Freaking love those things.
How long do you brine them for?
8 hours.
In like a
sometimes salt, overnight,
like salt and water, 50
salt sugar brine,
salt and sugar.
Yeah, too. Salt sugar, and I'll sometimes put honey in there. You see people putting all like, oh, a sprig of thyme. I just think that like that stuff is like it does not right. It doesn't pass into the meat. I don't think. I think that people put a lot of stuff in fish brines that there's no way you can taste later. I put rum in fish brines. Like when I do dry brines, I'll put rum in there. I've seen where you can slice up fennel and put alcohol on it and wind up getting like a fennel taste to it. But I think a lot of people put a lot of aromatics and stuff into brines, the brine fish. And there's no way that that flavor is carrying over in the necessary quantity where you can taste it above the taste of just like
smoke
brine and smoke fish.
Yeah, I think garlic. I think you can get garlic.
I can see you can get garlic
there.
On it.
Yeah.
Because garlic has a strong taste.
Yeah.
But putting like a sprig of green herbs, I just feel like when you see that kind of stuff, it's like, come on. It looks pretty, but it doesn't really matter. But yeah, that's how I would definitely go about cooking these roundies. And then lake trout, the other fish we have on the ice right now, is often criticized for being a tad oily. And it's one of those fish that, like, some people are dismissive of, but then people that love it really love it. Matt, my brother this year, smoked up some lake trout and brought it out. And my God, is the stuff good smoked. I think it's a great fish smoked. Joe, talk real quick about what your reluctance is about killing big lakers.
So, I don't like to kill big lakers because they're a pretty long-lived fish, and it takes them a while to get to the size to actually be able to like spawn. So, and if you catch, say, a mid 30 inch laker, it's probably 15 years, 18 years old, something like that. And I feel bad killing big fish like that.
The old ones.
Yeah.
You ever fish yellow eye rockfish?
That's different. I don't know why it's
why?
Different.
Why? Because it's 80?
I don't know why it's different.
Because it's 100 years old?
Because I don't know why. I like eating those. I don't know why there's a difference between...
Maybe that's it. Maybe it's the flavor. Maybe if the lake trout tasted as good as a yellow eye rock, you'd be whacking them.
Oh, I don't know if we'd have a lake trout left at that point.
Yeah, if a laker was... Because a yellow eye rockfish is a phenomenal fish.
Mm-hmm.
If a laker was that good, is it just because you kind of like, I don't really like them and they're old, and those two things combined makes me not want to kill them?
I think so, and... I've tried them before. Like you said, they're good smoke, so if we do get a small one and have to keep it, I wouldn't mind trying smoking it, but the times I've had it before I tried to have cooked it, I've just done it wrong, or the other person who's cooking it didn't prepare it right, maybe.
And it's left you feeling like, why even...
Yeah.
Why even give them the death stroke?
I pickled them and thought they were okay, but... I think pickled pike's better.
You like pickling northerns better?
Yeah.
Yeah, man, I just don't mind like bait. I don't mind baked lake trout. I like smoked lake trout. But I feel like I have like a little bit higher tolerances for
gaminess?
Or just, yeah, like I kind of like, you know, the thing I often say, man, I think that some stuff, there's like, I don't think it's everything's job to taste perfect. Right, there's just something that's like it's like interesting to mess with it, to experiment with it, and if something isn't absolutely perfect, I don't feel like it was like an inconvenience. You know what I mean? I don't mind cooking something and then being like, yeah, you know, next time I'm going to try this. I feel like that in and of itself is like a little bit educational and warrants some messing around. There's some things that I mess with, like common carp. I've messed them a few times, and in the end, I just have come to I've done it enough and had enough disappointment where now. I just don't feel like messing with common carp, right? And you'll still find guys that are like, think that common, oh, you got to do this, and fish cakes. You're right. You can basically turn it into a completely other substance with the addition of everything in your kitchen. But I don't look at them and feel, I just don't look at them and see food. But I still look at a laker and I'm like, yeah, man, that's like a food fish. All right, Brant, you got any concluding final thoughts as we sit here and watch the live screen TV?
Oh, it's our last night. I'm excited. I hope it turns on again.
Yeah, we had our first night.
Yep,
was on fire, and last night was just dead.
I wouldn't call it on fire. Our first night? Well,
relatively.
Over a hole and didn't. Yeah. Got one bite.
Okay.
Well, the tip-ups.
Tip-ups were going off. And when I'm saying on fire, I'm informing that by what happened the next night.
Yeah.
Right.
So with two nights to compare to, I think we had one night that was on fire and one night that was on ice.
Although we still saw a lot of fish. So if something... some unexplainable thing or something that some smart person might know about pressure or moon phase or light, you know, whatever turned them off last night. Hopefully that switch goes the other way tonight, and I think it'll be pretty fun.
Every fisherman has their own thing, but I do feel, as do a lot of anglers, that I think that barometric pressure has major implications for fish.
Yeah, that's my gut instinct, is a high pressure system will shut the bite off.
On burbot. Yeah.
I think on Lakers as well.
You think high pressure shuts Lakers down?
Yeah,
high pressure fires Northerns up, in my opinion. All right, Bryce, you got any concluding thoughts? Brant's concluding thought was he hopes we have a good night of fishing.
Well, I obviously agree with that as well.
You're hoping for a good night of fishing.
Yeah. Something a little better than yesterday. Hopefully we can jig a couple more up tonight like the first night, too.
And we probably got another hour of spearing before it gets too dark.
We can just throw that light down.
Yeah. Well, they just quit coming after a while. Last night we shined a light down there and never saw another whitefish once it got dark. I don't know what they do. They go somewhere and lay low. Joe?
I want people to appreciate the eel pout and not treat them like the Minnesota ice fishing walleye guys. Just kind of, if you do get a chance to go out for them, try cooking it up, because I think they're really good.
Would you go so far as to think that you're going to start the North American Eel Pout Alliance or the North American Eel Pout Foundation?
I don't know about that far.
But you do want people to know that it deserves your respect.
Yeah, and it's not just a trash fish that swims on the bottom of lakes picking up garbage.
Yeah, any wild thing that you would be so lucky as to have that wild thing grace you with its presence, right, warrants a level of admiration and respect, whether or not you think it's a good thing to eat or not. With some invasive species, like excluding that. But generally, yeah. To sort of wantonly, to kind of like wantonly destroy a native species of fish out of some misguided notion that you're going to be like improving other fisheries by disturbing a system that has been intact for tens of thousands of years, that you killing this fish for no reason is somehow going to like alter things for the better is a little absurd. Not you, but I'm just talking about a mug that would leave an eel pout on the ice.
Yeah.
Out of disdain for it. Yanni, I don't have any concluders, man. My concluder is just hoping more whitefish turn up before it gets dark.
Yeah, that'd be nice. It'd be nice to get a couple more shots each. But, yeah, I'd like to – I can dovetail off that a little bit. And just – I was thinking, as we're getting ready for the concluding thoughts here, that I was thinking, man, just another species to add to the list of, like, wild game where people are like, oh, that thing sucks. And then finally I'm like, oh, tried it. Guess what? Doesn't suck. Actually, pretty good. And what I was going to say, like, make a short list. And then I'm counting off in my head. I'm like, well, I've heard that about elk. Well, I've probably heard that about deer and moose and caribou antelope and bears, mountain lions. And by golly, if like some – so who are these people that however long ago like started this thing – where they were hunters and fishermen, they were sportsmen, and all of a sudden they're like, you know, I'm not really that into eating them. I'm just going to start saying they suck.
Yeah, it was some sort of like dramatic shift that came out of having
too many chickens growing for them.
Yep, it was like a thing farm. That it came out of. It came out of being spoiled by abundance of other stuff that people could start to have like disdain for, or negative feelings about the resources.
Yeah, so my concluding thought is next time you hear someone tell you that something's so-and-so is no good to eat, try it.
Oh.
Find a good recipe.
Yeah, if I didn't eat everything that someone told me is no good to eat, yeah, you'd just scratch off 90% of the wild harvest out there. All right, that's all. Thank you for joining.